This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. A new way of keeping water at bay is taking hold not only in eastern North Carolina, but up and down the East Coast, and local research is helping spread the word on living shorelines. In high wave action areas, man-made bulkheads make the most sense, but for low to medium wave areas, such as rivers, estuaries, and soundside properties, living shorelines can be more cost-effective and better for the environment. Bulkheads are a common sight along waterways in eastern North Carolina. The wood or concrete structures protect the shoreline from erosion and help keep water from encroaching on homes and businesses. But bulkheads can have negative impacts to the ecosystem. A more environmentally beneficial way of stabilization is living shorelines, whereby stone, gravel, or oyster shell-filled bags are placed one on top of the other, creating a sill.
These structures, the bags and the rocks, serve to protect the shoreline from erosion.
North Carolina Coastal Federation scientist Dr. Alexia Weaver supports living shoreline erosion management.
They help to reduce wave energies that affect the shoreline. And then the area landward of that structure is planted with thousands of plugs of marsh grass. So it not only looks very aesthetic and appealing, but it also functions really well in preventing erosion, protection from storms, and creating good oyster and salt marsh wetland habitat.
There are approximately 45 permitted living shorelines today in eastern North Carolina. Examples include an oyster shell sill along Taylor's Creek near Beaufort. In Moorhead City, Atlantic Beach, and Beaufort, there are living shorelines made of granite. And several private properties in Emerald Isle have stone sills. In the White Oak River, Weaver says there are multiple living shorelines around Jones Island.
Since 2007, we've been working out at Jones Island to prevent erosion of the island. The island has some really high bluffs that have been eroding through the years from tropical storms and hurricanes and also from boat wakes.
Weaver says 1,200 feet of oyster shell sills and over 60,000 plugs of marsh grass have been placed at Jones Island over the past 7 years. In 2009, a team of 65 Public Radio East volunteers and Marines built a 150-foot oyster shell bag sill to celebrate PRE's 25th anniversary. Weaver says that sill is still holding up.
They have built up a little bit of land behind them. The marsh grasses are doing great. We were actually just out there this week. They're full of mussels. They're full of crabs. We have stone crabs, mud crabs. There's a lot of fish that like to use the sills for habitat. So it's been a really successful project, both in terms of reducing erosion of the island, but also creating that valuable habitat for the species that live in the White Oak River.
One local researcher is making a name for herself in the marine science community. Rachel Gitman, a doctoral student at the University of Chapel Hill's Institute of Marine Sciences in Moorhead City, has been studying living shorelines since 2010. While her research focused on the ecology of salt marshes, she also studied the impact bulkheads have on the environment.
That bulkheads, particularly when they lack any kind of vegetation, tend to support lower abundances and diversity of fish and crustaceans, also of benthic infauna, so invertebrates that fish are feeding on. They tend to induce a kind of a scour or deepening of the shallow subtidal habitat, which can actually reduce the amount of suitable habitat for juvenile fish and crustaceans.
As part of Gitman's dissertation research, she evaluated different shoreline stabilization approaches and their effectiveness during storms.
I did find that for one storm event in particular, Hurricane Irene back in 2011, that marshes with these stone sill structures seaward of the marsh did actually perform better in some instances in terms of no changes in sediment, surface elevation, or vegetation density when compared to bulkheads along the same shoreline that oftentimes actually collapsed or suffered some kind of damage that would require the homeowner to do some form of maintenance or repair.
Another part of her research looked at the ability of living shorelines to offer habitat for fish and crustaceans.
It's really providing a refuge for juvenile fish and crustaceans. So it's a nursery for a lot of both commercial and recreationally valuable species, and also the species that those fish feed upon. So blue crabs love this shallow structured habitat. You'll find juvenile red drum, you'll find juvenile speckled trout, lots of pinfish and pigfish, lots of shrimp also use this structured habitat.
Gitman recently won a University of North Carolina's Graduate Education Advancement Board Impact Award for her research. Both state and federal policymakers and managers are using her findings as they address coastal management challenges.
I've taken the results of my research and I've presented it to the Division of Coastal Management and then also to the Coastal Resources Commission and basically tried to help them decide whether or not the current permitting processes for living shorelines are adequate, whether or not they need to make changes to the conditions of their general permit that they have in place for marsh sills, which is a type of living shoreline that includes this offshore structure with the marsh plantings.
Gitman says the Division of Coastal Management is still working with the Army Corps of Engineers to decide what changes could potentially be made to the permitting process. Before living shorelines become the accepted approach for erosion control, there are challenges to overcome. For instance, the permitting process for building a living shoreline is more arduous than for the construction of a traditional bulkhead.
The other major issue is the availability of materials. Oyster shell would be a preferred option for doing living shoreline work, but it's not necessarily available to every homeowner here, and granite and other structures can be expensive. Contractors are not as familiar with constructing living shorelines, and so they can often be hesitant to recommend that to a private property owner.
If you live along the water and are interested in constructing a living shoreline, the North Carolina Coastal Federation assists property owners in site assessment, submitting permits, ordering marsh grasses, and selecting a contractor to build the living shoreline. Building a living shoreline can be less expensive than constructing a seawall or bulkhead. However, the cost depends on the types of materials used and the size of the project.
Some of the local nurseries that we work with charge about 65 cents per individual plant. And depending on how long your shoreline is and how wide, you may plant between 500 to maybe a few thousand plants. And so that's going to be substantially less expensive than, say, putting in a bulkhead. If you want to put in a stone structure, granite can often be fairly expensive, and so it's probably on par with the construction of a bulkhead. It really depends on where you're located along the coastline and which contractor you use.
Preliminary research shows living shorelines are as effective in low-wave situations as bulkheads, but Gitman says decades of study needs to be conducted to determine if living shorelines offer the same amount of protection as bulkheads or seawalls over time. For more information on living shorelines and to see pictures of sills around eastern North Carolina, visit our website, publicradioeast.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. I've had a few people already ask me, well, we had a cold winter, so does that mean there'll be fewer mosquitoes? The answer, well, it's possible, but the weather that we have between now and June or July is going to have a whole lot more impact on our summer mosquito population than the weather we had over the winter. Now, I've already been bitten by a mosquito this spring and have had them in the house. We do have some species that overwinter as adults and respond quite quickly to rises in air temperature. Our major problem in North Carolina, however, is the Asian tiger mosquito. That mosquito spends its winter as an egg, and that egg needs water that the larvae can use for habitat after hatching, plus a warmer air temperature, and an increasing day length, more sunshine because the sun rises earlier and sets later, in order to trigger tiger mosquito activity. No doubt we have had more than enough water this spring. So now is a good time to start thinking about modifying the habitat around your yard and your neighborhood to try and avoid setting up the perfect storm of mosquito hatching madness. First of all, get rid of or repair all objects that collect water. Fix tarps that are covering boats or cars so they don't collect water. And if you're going to use a rain barrel, be sure that it's been cleaned of all leaf debris and other organic matter, and that they're covered with screens to exclude mosquitoes who want to lay eggs there. Clean out gutters that trap water, along with all the leaves and organic debris that attract the mosquitoes for egg-laying purposes. Clean out drainage ditches in front of your property. They're meant to catch and drain runoff, not provide sitting pools where mosquitoes can breed. So what's going to impact our mosquito season? Well, think about whether we're going to have drought or adequate rain. If things turn dry, there'll be fewer mosquitoes. If there's adequate rain, well, then there'll be better breeding spots for them. However, if we have extremely heavy rains, sometimes that flushes away the mosquito eggs and reduces the population somewhat. Tropical storms, of course, help boost mosquito populations. So while we're talking about biting pests, let me also mention ticks. We're a little ways away from tick season, but I've already had live ticks on the dogs in my yard. So do note that they're out there looking for a meal, just not in great numbers yet. The best thing you can do is keep your yard mowed, especially mow back taller weeds along the edges of your yard, fences, and paths. These habitats favor field mice and other hosts of the common tick. And although we're not quite into tick season, it is a good idea to check yourself when you come in, especially if you've been working around these high weed habitats. I hope you don't encounter any mosquitoes or ticks out in your yard this week, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
This weekend, scientists are hoping to launch a one-year study to determine if offshore conditions along the North Carolina coast are favorable for wind energy facilities. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill will deploy two 3,000-pound buoys to collect information on water and atmospheric conditions in the Atlantic. Professor of Marine Sciences Harvey Syme says they'll use the information to help identify viable lease block locations for offshore wind farms.
The intent here is to take a closer look at what the offshore wind energy resource is like and to carefully document its structure to help define where and where not to consider deployment of offshore wind turbines.
In 2008, the North Carolina State Legislature requested that a study be conducted to look at the viability of offshore wind energy in our state.
The university played a big role in putting together a report for the state at that time over the next year, and we found that there was reason to be encouraged that offshore wind energy might be feasible off of North Carolina.
There has been a series of follow-up projects conducted since the study. The most recent will be the placement of the two buoys 20 miles off the coast. A large donut-shaped flotation collar, around 6 to 7 feet in diameter, will be below the surface of the water. The visible section consists of a 12-foot superstructure equipped with high-tech meteorological instruments.
On the superstructure are a number of sensors to measure properties of the atmosphere, the main ones being the wind speed and direction. We have a couple of anemometers redundant so we can make sure we're getting the right measurement. Air temperature, air humidity, air pressure, rainfall, things that tell us about how cloudy it is. And in addition, a camera that'll take a snapshot of the sea surface conditions every hour.
Just below the water's surface and at a depth of 50 feet, special instruments will record the ocean's temperature and salinity. The two buoys will be anchored to the seafloor about 80 miles apart. One will be located north of Cape Hatteras and the other off Ocracoke Island. Syme says the buoys will be placed in areas where there's a lack of data indicating a favorable spot for wind energy development.
The intent is to try and fill in the holes in the historical database in sites that look like they should be promising based on other data, but we've never taken measurements in those particular locations.
Syme says the areas where they are conducting their research will be in non-conflict areas, which are places that don't disrupt military, fishing, and ecological activities. The purpose of the research project will focus mainly on collecting information about wind speed and direction. Syme says they'll study how the proximity of the Gulf Stream to the continental shelf creates a seemingly favorable environment for wind energy facilities.
This is the Gulf Stream closest approach to the continent anywhere along the eastern seaboard except off of Florida. And so when it comes close to the land, it essentially serves as a big energy source and helps pump up the wind field. We know that from what happens in the wintertime and spinning up strong storms right off of our coast.
The buoys are equipped with satellite communications, which will transmit data back to shore every hour. According to SIME, the data will be available to the public, as well as local and commercial mariners, divers, weathermen, and scientists. He says the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration will be the primary receiver of the data and will help distribute the information globally.
The data from the buoys will flow into the National Weather Service's model systems, will help with forecasting. We'll also be hosting our own website to present the data to people as well.
The original buoys were purchased nearly a decade ago. After an extensive $100,000 retrofit, the pair of buoys were deployed off the coast in 2011. But before the research could be completed, the buoys were severely damaged, either intentionally or by accident. SIME is hoping to alert mariners to be on the lookout for the buoys and any suspicious activity.
The buoys are marked with their identification numbers from NOAA, these NDBC numbers, and they have a website on them that fairly easy to access so that you could go in there and just let us know if you think something's not looking right. We'd also ask that people don't tie off to the buoys. They're big and robust, but the instruments themselves are fairly delicate. So if you try to throw a line on them, you might end up damaging some of the equipment.
When the buoys are deployed, they will spend a year in the Atlantic collecting data. SIME is hoping the project will receive more funding and can be extended so they're able to document atmospheric and ocean conditions over a longer period of time. You can see pictures of the research buoys at our website, publicradioeast.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh.
Hello, Tom the Jazzman here, inviting you to join me this Sunday evening and every Sunday evening right here on Public Radio East. We play some of the finest jazz you'll hear anywhere in the world, and it's only right here on Public Radio East on all five frequencies every Sunday evening from 6 until 11 p.m. That's Tom the Jazzman on PRE.
Followed by Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired at 11 p.m. on PRE Public Radio East News and Ideas.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our Public Radio East members in partnership with Tryon Palace, offering gift ideas from the museum store, including fine crafts and jewelry, pottery, books, decorative and fine art. The museum store, located in the History Center. Information online at tryonpalace.org. A new collection of short stories by a Chatham County author recounts fictional tales of those falling in love, sometimes with each other, but more often with a place. George Olson spoke with Marjorie Hudson and has this, which originally aired in October 2011.
Marjorie Hudson's description of how she writes may give you the wrong idea about what you're preparing to read.
You know, writing for me often comes in kind of a gush and an outpouring, and it's a big mess, and I do a lot of sweating over it.
Once the gush passes, though, comes the revisions, something she says doesn't happen one, two, three, or four times, but more likely in the 20 to 30 times range. That meticulousness is evident in her new short story collection, Accidental Birds of the Carolinas, where it's apparent that every word was carefully considered before being shared with you.
It takes no time at all to fall in love with such a place if you're paying attention. All it takes is a Luna moth quivering on your porch light, a newborn mantid's quick infant maw attacking your little finger in the grass, a strange throbbing from the shrubbery at dusk, mysterious and sweet and insistent as sex, the call of a country bird, a whippoorwill. All it takes is a particular scent, the breath of a place like a lover's breath before a kiss, full of the richness of life, digestion, desire. How can I describe this place? It was rich as molecules. I knew the microbes of the soil lifted to my tongue. Sometimes rain fell, metallic and dusty as a tin roof. All these things held in the air like the gold must of evening or the pink chatter of dawn. In those first weeks, I lay in my bed, heart pounding with yearning for this place where I lived, my body infused with a delicious loneliness. Mine, I mouthed to the glimmering, dying day. I wanted to die so I could merge my molecules with that mungy ferment. I wanted to die of happiness.
Marjorie Hudson reading from The Clearing, the opening story of her Accidental Birds collection. It's the story in the book that is most autobiographical, still fiction, but trying to capture an experience the Chatham County resident shared with the story's lead character, Elizabeth Enfield, of falling in love with place.
I think when I moved here, it was in an autumn of 1984, and I was living in a farmhouse at the end of a dirt road, and I became rapturous in response to the beauty after living in the city and being kind of burned out. And I noticed things. I felt the pull of place on the molecular level. I really feel that. I sort of noticed that. I think there's something in the air after rain. I think there's something in the air when it's dry. There's a certain kind of magic that is in the scent of a place and in the sounds of birds. I was really enraptured and mystified and kind of put in a magic spell by the place where I lived.
That particular place is celebrated throughout the bulk of her stories. Most of the stories take place in the fictional North Carolina county, Ambler County, which in description sounds much like the Chatham County where Marjorie Hudson resides. The stories also feature brief guest appearances, if you will, by characters from other stories. So while Accidental Birds may be a collection of stories, it's a collection that builds an impression of place, in particular a place for those starting anew.
I got out of the car. I looked around. This was a place I'd been looking for my whole life. There didn't seem to be any people in it. The river was wild and brown, running over rocks, and purple vines were growing over everything. Together, the river and vines smelled like grape jelly and mud. Somebody's sneakers were hanging in a tree over the water. Next to the river was an old stone building with a roof caved in. On the other side of the river was a long, low, red brick building with tall chimneys and broken-out windows. I already loved it. "Looks like the end of the road," I heard my own voice say. Yes, I was already talking to myself, an early sign of madness, my mother used to say.
An excerpt from the story Providence, featuring the tale of a woman leaving an abusive relationship and deciding on a whim to settle in the rural South. It's not the only story where someone escapes to the South. The Clearing also features a refugee from the North, while The Outside World tells the story of a Midwestern teen who comes to North Carolina for college and ends up married and living on an Ambler County farm. Hudson herself was an escapee, saying she came to North Carolina burnt out from working in Washington, D.C., and found the rural South to be a good destination for those seeking a new beginning.
I have found where I live to be a very welcoming place to the newcomer. There's something about kindness to strangers. It's one of those things where you get used to telling the story of your life because that's what people do here. They take the time to talk. And then you go back to visit your city friends and they think you've gone crazy. So there's something kind of cherishing about a community. And communities are easier to identify in small towns and rural places. If you want them, you can have them.
Not all the stories have characters enchanted by the simple life. The book's title story, Accidental Birds of the Carolinas, recounts the tale of a retired Army officer who plots a somewhat macabre escape from North Carolina living. While Hudson spends so much of the book telling the tales of people escaping to the South, Accidental Birds takes almost a Hitchcockian twist to tell of a man who now must find a way to adapt to his surroundings.
It is kind of a haunted story, though. I do see that because my character is very kind of self-involved and he's very disconnected with his new surroundings. He really hates his retirement village. He loathes it, and his wife has fallen in love with it. So for him to be left in a community where he doesn't feel a community is really one of the hardest circumstances a person can live through.
The story is the one comparatively dark moment of the book. While the bulk of the book isn't always happily ever after or redemptive, there does seem to always be a way forward. And in Hudson's experience, and in her character's experience, that way forward can be found in a simple act of recognition endemic in the South.
They have this thing in Chatham County we call the one-finger salute, and it's not the finger people use in New York City to salute each other. It's just the index finger goes up on your steering wheel as you pass, and people just kind of know that they know who you are, and if they don't know who you are, it doesn't matter. They're just saying hello. I really see it as a kind of a connection that actually goes deeper. It's a way of saying, I see you. You know, it's almost a namaste.
Accidental Birds of the Carolinas is written by Chatham County author Marjorie Hudson and is published by Press 53 of Winston-Salem. I'm George Olson.